The following broadcast was produced by the Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco as part of our Lighthouse Learning Library.
Do you think that Perry's vision of where he wanted us to go as a blind community was a series of spectacular individual accomplishments, or was there, this was before the NFB, before almost any collective action, did he have a collective sense too, or was it really him mentoring spectacular individuals one by one?
He had his hands full. For example, I think it was Bob Campbell, who was a bosom buddy of Chick Tenbrook. And that was one of the real tragedies of the split between the organizations. We're sick of school, and they told him, they marched into his office and told him they were quitting and that they were going to go to work on a farm. And he let them do it. And they came back the next year, and he was fairly confident that they would come back. I don't know how he saw a grand picture. I really don't know. I know that we were admiring a Japanese model of an accessible abacus, which the Cranmer abacus, was coming out about the same time. And Tim Cranmer had said that he sort of admired the Japanese one more than his own. But I remember being at Dr. Perry's house when somebody walked in with one. And those things delighted him. A lot of things delighted him that I suspect he didn't have intellectual, or didn't he had intellectual time for lots of stuff. He didn't have visionary time for, I would guess, because he was fascinated with that. He was fascinated with puzzles. His wife would read puzzles out of the newspaper, and he'd solve them. Yeah. He was a busy man engaging himself. So I don't know that he went around thinking that he might be the civil rights leader of the day. I think that was Jacobus Tenbrook's more to what he was after.
Let me just bring up briefly something that we talked about on the phone that we couldn't go very far with on the phone, but I want to record here. On the website of the American Action Fund, which is the successor to the American Brotherhood of the Blind, and which now distributes free canes and also runs the Jernigan Lending Library for Children, and on the website, it says that the name American Brotherhood of the Blind was chosen because among its founders was someone who was taken with theosophy and the philosophy of Madame Blavatsky. The theosophists firmly believed in the universal brotherhood of mankind. So the word brotherhood was taken from the theosophists' point of view and applied to the brotherhood, the universal brotherhood of the blind. In this case, the American Brotherhood of the Blind. You said that you were unfamiliar with that, but that your father was receiving the magazine, The Theosophist, in Braille.
You couldn't stop it. He wasn't interested in it, and you couldn't stop it. It was one of those things where you could say, the recipient is long deceased. It wouldn't matter. Seemed like you couldn't stop it. But he got these things, and I even took a swing at it when I was about 12 or 14. I couldn't make any sense out of it, but it seemed to me like it may have had a lot of, you would have had to have some pre-introduction to it in order to understand it. But so I had no idea about any of that. And I didn't know till I talked to you that it had any connection with, that any of those connections were made. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's. I only know it because of what it says on the website. I was told that Jim Omvig, had prepared the website, and I wrote to him and asked him what he knew about it, and he said he didn't really know. I don't know where he got the information from, but I'd love to track that down. So Perry spent time in Europe. He'd gone to the California school himself, I believe, yeah. and was mentored by a sighted guy who encouraged him, uh-huh. as I understand. Then he went to Europe, came back, founded the Alumni Association of the California School, and that's what evolved into the California Council. In the meantime, he had established the Brotherhood that was whose intention initially, I believe, was to provide support for his boys to go to Cal.
He didn't necessarily see grand successes, let's put it that way. I don't think he was critical of that. There was a brilliant mathematician who was an older kid. He'd come from the Arkansas school and was a student at Berkeley for at least his early teens. And he was one of Dr. Perry's favorites because he was absolutely his intellectual equal. He was in mathematics. And he became a tutor of Cal students in all of the sciences. And the way he did it is that he got his reading done by helping the students who read to him do their homework. And he would only accept $1 an hour. And by 1962, when I was in trouble in high school math, I was shipped over to him.
Huh.
And my father said, "Buck, they make more than that in minimum wage." And he said, "Yes, but I get better students this way." I kept Buck is his last name, Eston Buck, but everybody called him Buck. He was a strange, small man walking around campus. By 1940, he had taken every mathematics course that had been taught there, and he was making this pittance of a wage, living in a very modest abode. His mother wasn't too far away. They were Arkansas people. And he was one of Dr. Perry's favorites, and Dr. Perry recommended that we go see Buck.
Huh.
So he didn't see necessarily everybody become the mainstream success that the best and the brightest kids would have achieved.
What became of Mr. Buck?
He died shortly after. He died in 1978. I think it's too bad because I would have loved to have shown him my magazine. I revived copied in philosophical sense. A technical magazine that came from New York, from a blind fellow, just a bright guy. Again, not a credentialed teacher, but he was a teacher at the New York Institute for the Education of the Blind. And he started a technical magazine called the Braille Technical Press in 1950. And that's Robert W. Gunderson. And I patterned a magazine after his magazine, and Buck died before I could show him the first copy. So he hung around for a long time, and he was a very popular tutor, and he did this stuff in his head.
So he was a tutor. He lived as a tutor in Berkeley until his death.
Yeah.
Huh. You told me earlier a story about your father and other kids going into the hills and reading.
Yeah, this was brought up twice. I think it was brought up at Bob Campbell's funeral. And and George Fogarty's retirement, and they were roommates, all four of them. Bill Gary was the smallest of the group. There was Chick Tenbrook was a large person because my father got one of his shirts by mistake, and rode home with it, and he said he was swimming in this shirt. And Bob Campbell and George Fogarty. Bob Campbell carried on with the Department of Advanced Studies, which would actually back you with reader service and so forth if rehab wouldn't have you. And George Fogarty was a counselor in the Department of Rehabilitation in Oakland. So anyway, they were buddies, and they could read well, and my father was small enough to slither through the library window off hours. So they would break into the library, and he would pass volumes of Braille books out the window and then leave the building. I don't know if he went in. He left the same way. I never heard that. But they would go into the Berkeley Hills on weekends and read to each other. And the famous story, which I've heard too many times to think there wasn't true, was during Thanksgiving weekend, when they had a four-day weekend, they snuck out with all nearly 20 volumes of The Count of Monte Cristo and went to the Berkeley Hills and read till it was over. And I cooked for themselves and so forth up there and camped out.
Yeah. I'd love to just hear a little bit more of the color of that time, what your father told you about life as a blind student in the early 20s. Did they use canes?
No.
How did they travel? Did they cook? How did they just get through life?
After school, you mean, or at the school?
Both.
Well, mobility training was the first mobility training my father got was when he got a guide dog in 1938. That was the first formal training. So he was 28 years old.
So 20 years after the school.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And how I learned something about, well, how we both learned about the long cane technique is my mother, at the 1956 convention, we went to Oakland and toured the Orientation Center for the Blind. Then we had lunch, and she saw people being trained using the long cane technique. And so she really was just enraptured by this observation. So she said, well, let's go buy canes. So we went and we bought those aluminum canes with a crook handle and so forth. They weren't as long as what we'd expect now. And she said, here's what they were doing. So she told my father and me, showed us how it worked. And that was the first exposure he had to formal use of long cane technique, which of course was an invention of World War II.
So you said that during the 20s, teens and 20s, these boys didn't have canes at all?
That's correct. In fact,
so they scrambled up the hills.
No, some of us walked funny. A lot of them made fun of one particular kid who put his feet so far in front of him that you could hear him kick things everywhere he went. And my father's comment about the cane, he says, "Oh, the canes they gave us were so short and useless. You might as well carry a magazine." And now there were a lot of broken dark glasses. And
you know, we have at the center now, we have as an exhibit a cane that reputedly belonged to Jacobus Tenbrook. that apparently after he died, Hazel Tenbrook gave to Mary Willows, who's now the president of the state affiliate here, and Mary Willows turned it over to Mark Maurer at the 2009 NFB convention in Detroit, and we've mounted it so that it's on the wall as a tactile display for blind guys that want to come and see it. It's a cane that's maybe 3.5 feet long with a crooked handle, and
the Lions gave those away years after the long cane technique. Well, I heard stories, of course, about them on a bus. You know, they were on a bus, and some unsuspecting goofball said, "My, it's wonderful to see you boys out. Who dresses you?" And Chick, of course, not to be outdone, said, "Oh, it's awful. In order for it to get get done, they wake us up at 3, sometimes 4 in the morning, and to get us just ready for breakfast." And, you know, he just went on and on like that for a while, till the person, I guess, they didn't know how he disappeared, but he must have just gone off shaking his head. Another thing Chick would do is if he'd ask directions of somebody, he'd hear some footsteps, and he'd ask a question. And if they didn't answer, he'd say, "Go to hell."
And did you experience that with him, or is this just stories you were told?
I didn't know him too well. I certainly have met him, and I remember my mother picking me up so I could see his beard. You know, he was approachable. But the one who was approachable was his dear wife, Hazel. What a wonderful person she was. My goodness. And she gave me the best post-educational advice that I got. I didn't get nearly as good explanation of what a resume did and how, you know, that I had to have these or those connections to get into offices of personnel people and all that. I didn't know how sighted kids were getting, sighted men, grown men, were getting connections in, you know, after college, after my college.
Mm-hmm.
And Hazel Tenbrook was always approachable.
Hmm.
He was busy.
Hmm.
Now, you were 9 in 1956.
Right.
The disability activists today think disability politics really started in 1973, say, with the occupation of the 504 demonstrations.
Which the Federation was against, by the way.
Well, we may get into that in a minute. But there were 1,000 people at the 56 NFB convention here in San Francisco. What do you remember about that? You told us about seeing the long canes. What else can you...
Oh, we sat through every meeting there. And as a kid, I was sort of impatient. I saw the first thermoform machines that were out. They predated that some, but, oh, man, because we had a friend... from the Utah school, by the way, while we were in Reno, a dear family friend who had that god-awful rheumatoid arthritis that blinded him as a baby, and he was all scrunched up and deformed, but just the funniest human being. But he lived in constant pain. Sometimes he could only open his mouth so much as you could stick a finger in there. Mm. And he was a scribe. He would take, for money, no doubt, a braille book in his left hand, a board slate to his right, and copy that book.
Wow.
Copy, hand-copied braille, probably to start with. And he would make another copy. And that's the kind of employment that I remember seeing. I remember seeing, for example, this. We had in our piano shop an idea that my father had of renting tape recorders for 75 cents a day. These were the big suitcase things, you know, in 1952. And so that we set a guy up with his own recording business with these lower cost home recording pieces of equipment that were coming out. And we were awfully proud of him because one of his jobs was to listen to the radio, tape record the radio, and then fish through that and find out how many sponsors' spots had been aired in a particular day and log that and let the advertisers know that their advertisements had been good. You know, this was low level, just bottom of the barrel work, but we were proud of these people, very proud. And we did have the pride, by the way, of the Rosie the Riveter bunch who got jobs in World War II, some of whom kept those jobs.
What type of jobs were blind women getting in World War II?
No, these were blind folks. These were blind men alongside women, regular women.
Regular women?
Yeah.
Are blind women irregular?
You have to ask them. You won't hear a yes answer from a Federationist woman, not at all. But Martin Christopher was a good friend of ours, and he got a job finishing off sprinkler or injection systems. He described them as like sprinkler heads, but they were injection nozzles for diesel engines for the Caterpillar Tractor Company. They had a big facility in Oakland during the war and after. And he said, "I've tried to train other blind people at this, but they just can't. They don't have the stamina for it. Makes their hand tired, and they don't show up for work."
Hmm.
So that's what he did. And he was just a machine operator of a fairly low-level type. Didn't matter to us. He was employed.
Well, no, what's interesting, though, is that I didn't realize that there was an analogous situation for blind men or blind people in general as there was for sighted women in taking jobs that were available because sighted men were not available to do them.
George Fogarty and Bob Campbell went to places of work. George could see some. So with his nose to the paper, he could look at things. He could read and so forth. And Bob Campbell was totally blind. And they would try jobs and say, "We can get you a client."
Huh.
And they got a lot accomplished that way. This Lowenfeld paper, I didn't finish, I think. It covered those kinds of occupations, and it's tabulated at the end as to what these graduates were doing. And there were tons of different, there was variety in that you don't really expect. You wouldn't see it in Europe when I went and I was employed for 3 months in Paris. And you didn't see that variety among blind folks in France. I figured, well, this ought to be a hip place. They make blind people every 20 years over here. and the variety of the kinds of work was not evident. Anyway, so I heard Lowenfeld deliver that paper. I didn't understand the words, but I heard him deliver it in 1956. I heard numerous votes come up and resolutions and so forth. And I ran across a tape recording of my 14-year-old sister, because I was 9, she was 14, proofreading a typed letter that my father had written to his mother and sending to Reno. And she read this part, and it's just heartrending to hear it. He said, "You should have seen Chick up there holding forth. You'd have been very proud of him." With, I think the crowning thing was that banquet speech has a conclusion that summarized the way I felt coming out of that convention at the age of 9, is that one could be proud, very, very proud, which is exactly what Brian talks about with his experience at the Sacramento Center, and what is talked about of the people who are interviewed after Jernigan went to the Iowa rehab and squared it away with the center there. They set these people free. And the last paragraph of that 1956 banquet speech went something like this. "You often hear, 'There but for the grace of God go I.' It conjures a beggar by the side of the road, and a passerby maybe offers alms, maybe not, but walks by. In what unspeakable arrogance! 'There but for the grace of God go I,' as if there's some special grace afforded to one over another. And yet, with a very small modification, let us recommend this: here within the grace of God go we." Huh. And I remember the room caught fire. It just, there was an amazing roar of people who had never heard that before.
Wow, you know, I've read that speech, and hearing you paraphrase the final paragraph just brings it to life. It's amazing. Mm. It's beautiful.
I felt very, very proud as a blind person for a while there after that. And yet my father said on more than one occasion, "I am not a man until I am standing in front of a piano that needs my service."
Wow.
What a tragic thing to comment. And when we were buying a car, in 1959, we were buying a car, and he says, "How come they don't show me the best of their models? Do I have to dress in a tuxedo or what?" Mm-hmm. He didn't feel like a man a lot of the time. And
even with Newell Perry's...
Yeah. I mean, we didn't see our same success. I didn't expect it either. I really didn't expect much of myself. Even after Cal Poly. Turns out I have a kind of an impressive body of work behind me. But I don't know, man. I think it's a hard one to do without having a large group of people whom you can really visit and see the same stuff. Where it can go wrong is if there's any of this God-blessed arrogance that can go on. That arrogance is deadly. It's what Dr. Tenbrook preached against. And yet he had a good dose of it.
Mm-hmm. How did it work for you practically in the 1950s? Here you were you were an adolescent, you were defining yourself and that sense of self-worth, your, Dr. Tenbrook's words, right to live in the world. How did it, did you talk to folks all the time on the phone? Did you go to meetings? Was it just in the air?
I was mainstreamed, and we did very little Federation involvement. Most of what we did was in Nevada. We had tape recorders, and we tape recorded some meetings. Mm-hmm. One meeting anyway that I remember. It's honestly, in a way, we were close to, we were two doors away in Castro Valley from a Federation lawyer, Hugh Coford. But that was as close as we got, other than an occasional conversation with somebody, particularly with piano associates. Occasionally I remember an account of a conversation with Chick Tenbrook. My father called him up, and they had a conversation on some other thing, and he asked how we were doing, and my father told him the amount of money that the piano business was making. He says, "Jesus Christ, I'm in the wrong position." Because that little shop brought in $35,000 in 1951.
Wow.
Mm. That's the business they liquidated.
In order to take you to the California
school.
Yes. Your family went to the 56th convention just because it happened to be in San Francisco.
Yeah. Right.
Did you go to state conventions?
No.
So your father really was not involved with the Federation
at
all.
That's correct. Yeah.
But you ended up somewhat more involved. You got to know Hazel Tenbrook well.
I started going to the state convention in when I entered college. I found that to be quite interesting, really. You know, I would say that we had our great men still here. We had Muzzy Marcellino was holding forth, and Tony Menino was an impressive president. And there was a fellow named Jim McGinnis who had been sort of chased out for some reason or other, and he started Blind San Franciscans with his wife Jewel, and they accomplished a lot here. They did sort of stick with the Federation philosophy and all its lack of desire to compromise in the issues.
I have the booklet that Perry Sengquist published in 1969 called Aid to the Blind in California, 50 Years of Program Development.
Yeah, neat.
And it starts with some discussion of the, here's where Tenbrook said, "With plenty of ambition but no money, I wanted to enter the university. At that point, I was denied state aid to the blind, a program then newly instituted as a result of doctors' efforts," and just doctors' efforts, in sponsoring a constitutional amendment and comprehensive statute. "The reason was not that my need was not great. It was that I intended to pursue a higher education." So I thought that there was some photos in here. I might be mistaken.
Dr. Tenbrook was pretty relentless, too, about we better call him Dr. Tenbrook.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, sure.
I've
That's where all that came from, you know, the Mr. and Mrs. and stuff.
I thought it started with Jernigan. Huh?
No.
So what manifestations of arrogance on Tenbrook's part did you?
Well, the one story that I only can give you first hand. Is my father remembers being with one of the readers from Cal during study hour, and apparently, you know, there sometimes weren't enough readers to go around or for whatever reason, and the young Chick Tenbrook, high school boy, was pacing around trying to find somebody. And my dad said, "Well, Chick's actually looking for somebody." And because he had his reader, you know, maybe he was going to offer her services to Chick. But she said, "Oh, he is so arrogant, I can't stand working for him."
Yeah.
He was, well, that got the control guy next door. I just heard him do something. He was a very directed fellow.
Mm-hmm.
And some criticisms of Dr. Ten Broeck were that he was just unbendable.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know about that. I mean, he would have been nice to me had I been more in his company. He thought a lot of my father, because they had had these hillside adventures, you know, together.
Hmm. Earlier today, we were talking about the split in the NFB and what the NFB calls the Civil War. And we were also talking about the occasions when you met Kenneth Jernigan when he was here in California for a few years Tennessee and Iowa. And then you, on a phone, you mentioned that you'd met him again in Baltimore
yeah,
when
him
you visited.
Several times. The first time, the young Ken Jernigan had really sort of gotten himself in, he was installed as some officer, if not head of the Orientation Center for the Blind up here in it was in Oakland at the time. And when we went and visited him, we got the little tour of the Orientation Center and so forth, we sat in his office for a little while, and my mother said, "Get up on the chair and look around the room." The whole room, the perimeter of the room, was lined with Braille books. He was a very impressive, energetic young man, and he did a lot of good. And to this day, I think he should be remembered most for convincing those of us who were not veterans to, "Oh, come on, try this tool. Try this cane of a reasonable length. This is good stuff." And he convinced us as civilians to use it.
Hmm.
And that took years. I mean, we're talking into the late 50s that people carried canes and some of us knew how to use them. Whereas that's 12 years after the veterans had already been trained with it. But it takes a long time to convince people who partly didn't want to be blind. I mean, who does, for example? And to say this will really be a good tool to get around.
How did you happen to be visiting him in the orientation center?
Well, that was at the time of the convention. We just came over across the bay.
What else do you remember about his time here?
That's it. Mm-hmm. That's all I remember. The next time I saw him was as a student in college, when he visited our student division within the California. In those days, California Council of the Blind, still, before it became NFBC, and then the California Council name has been traded back and forth ever since.
Yes.
And then you met Jernigan again in Baltimore one time?
Yes. I went back.
What brought you there?
They thought I was the guy who was going to bring them these Elinfa digi-cassette Braille, sort of like a VersaBraille became a much more elaborate version was the VersaBraille. But anyway, this was this French-made thing. I went back there to try and convince the Federation to steal an engineer from AFB. There was a brilliant man who was actually involved in weather satellite stuff, the telemetry for weather satellites. And he ultimately ended up doing some great work with at AFB with talking instruments and things like that. And in fact, he had so much doubt about electronic travel aids that he made one, an ultrasonic one, that could be programmed, he said, to do anything. You tell me what you want out of this thing. And so he showed it to me. He was this wonderful New Yorker guy. He says, "Yeah, I'll show you this thing. I know that there's only one mode you're going to like. That's number 8, but let's go through the first of them." And, you know, and it would tell you in feet and inches, or it would tell you, and then would, you know, beep and bloop, bloop, or whatever you wanted. And came to number 8, and he says, "Hey, here's the one you're going to like. Dee, 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 dee."
So,
and he says, so I asked the mobility instructors, what they want me to do with it. What, I'll make them whatever they want. And they haven't come up with one idea. And that's the actual, that's when I sort of became thoughtful about electronic travel aids. And I've got to, I could give you a lecture on what I think of that. But anyway, so I went back there to say to NFB, you could have him, take him. You know what he's doing for AFB, and you know he's being criticized every step of the way. You could have him. And they just saw me as too young. Ultimately, of course, then Tim Cranmer set up the technical committee, which then Tim Cranmer drafted me as a member. I wouldn't have done it for anybody else, but he got me.
Why don't you talk about him some?
Oh, now there's an interesting boy. He, all blind people are piano tuners. Did you know that? Everyone. Brian, how come it missed you? I know, you went blind too late. Tim was involved in everything that was interesting, anything. He wrote some very interesting articles in that Braille Technical Press that was around from, as I say, from 1950 to 1973. I remember an article on how to make Braille dials with a board slate. I was only, maybe I was 10 years old by then, and reading my father's copies of these things lying on his closet floor. And there was this name, Tim Cranmer. What a strange name. And he reckoned that the abacus might be a better way than trying to do arithmetic on a slate or on a Braille writer. It was still cumbersome. You had on the Perkins, your left hand did a carriage, you know, you could pull the carriage back and forth or let it go forward.
Mm-hmm.
On the right hand was a backspace. You had to reach up for a knob of, you know, to turn the paper in and out.
I think a slate would be easier than
It was no good either because you couldn't read it because, that's another thing I saw was upward writing slates at the foundation table at the 56 convention. Mm. But
of
still,
course, you had to write upward since you were writing backward if it was going to.
Well, you just, you couldn't see what you were writing. You couldn't read it back.
That's right.
Oddly enough, I got through school with a Hall Braille writer by choice because you could make all those operations with the right hand.
Huh.
So that's how I got through calculus and all. But anyway, so he figured the abacus would be pivotal. And he was right. And Fred Gassoni wrote the book using the Cranmer abacus, which was a very good book, written for non-technical types on how to use the abacus. I bet you they used that at the orientation center, which they had a whole course on Abacus. You took that, they took it as seriously as Braille. Hmm. So, and then he got into the computer stuff. He met a young boy named Dean Blasey, whom he sort of mentored. And then Dean Blasey outstripped us all. And
now Blasey is sighted, right?
Yes. Whoop. Sorry, next door. And he, Blasey designed a golfer's scorekeeping program on a Hewlett-Packard, I think, computer of some sort, on a smart calculator. They made things that were sort of calculators plus. And for Tim, he made it do Morse code. Not that Tim was golfing, but he said, this can be a phone book. This can be all kinds of stuff. It got Tim hooked on computers. And, well, it just went from Katie bar the door. I mean, honest to Pete. Many of the advances that got us through to the point of, let's say, up to JAWS and those programs were inspired by Tim Cranmer. How he became Dr. Cranmer is one of the guys who worked for him called me up and said, we'd like letters of support so that the, probably the University of Frankfurt would give Tim a honorary doctorate. And so I said, sure enough. So I wrote an article on the Renaissance man and all that. He got his doctorate, so I called him up to congratulate him. He says, I bet this is not one of a kind, but an unusual case of where a person with a seventh grade education got an honorary university doctorate.
Yeah. Where what happened to the article you wrote about him?
Yeah, that's on the bottom of somebody's birdcage, I would suspect. I don't think I have a copy.
No, it's too bad.
It was good, though.
When did
but
Cranmer...
I wrote a eulogy about him,
uh-huh.
And that I have someplace.
Where did he live?
He was in Frankfort, Kentucky.
Huh.
Huh. And you couldn't get there from here. It was hard to get there. But I went back to... I went back to investigate how could we present graphics to blind people. And I went to visit a guy in Georgia Tech who was using a Diablo printer with you could feel the periods. I went to Silver Spring, Maryland, where there was a blind computer programmer, had one of the first line printers by Triformation Systems. They had been around for a while, but he had one that he could make generate graphics. I went to Frankfurt and hung out with Tim for a while, and he had a thing he called the SAD, the Searchable Audible Display. And Dean Blasey had made some prototypes of things like this where the thing was covered with rivets with a copper backplane, and as you touched a rivet and joined it up with the backplane, it would speak that position. So he was an early one on that. Noel Runyon in Campbell, California also designed such a thing. And there became a thing called the Nomad. We actually worked on one too. We all thought it was a great idea to have a touch screen that when you poke at would talk. Little did we know that there was one important element missing, and that was memory of where you were last.
Yeah.
And that was their greatest failing. There was a guy who solved that in Europe. He had a thing called a tactile acoustic screen orientation with sliders. One horizontal and one vertical. And that actually fixed that because you could leave those sliders where you left them, type something, and you were looking at where you were on the screen when you, yeah. Anyway, Tim Cranmer was a pioneer in all this, and a nicer guy you never met.
When did he die?
Oh, he died of old age and facilitated partly by smoking. But he was an elderly man, there was no question about it.
Bill, there are people today, young kids growing up who are blind, who surf the internet and have everything at their fingertips. And then there are people who came up through the ranks over the last half century and know what it is to wire up a vacuum tube and to have discrete components and to build stuff.
That's components that don't talk outside of, don't kiss and tell. The transistor that kisses and tells. Can be vicious.
Have we lost something in our ability to interact that way as blind people? What was it like?
Oh, to interact as blind people? I know it's probably not. As to what people are going to do, that puzzles me. I have no idea what people would do unless they enter the medical profession. What the hell are they going to do? For a living, for creating, for doing stuff. During the dot-com thing, that was the most artificial, rubbish construct of creativity, oversold. People thought that creating was to run somebody else's application program. Creativity is not that. And the same number of people who were creative back then are going to be creative now.
You just don't know how, is that what you mean?
I don't know how.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's interesting on creativity. Was I creative? I have a big, long body of work. But I documented it in a thing called Devices Supportive of Research. And I have a poster book that folds out to be 10 feet long. And in there are all manner of illustrative instrument ideas for electrical instruments. Or and beyond, like our audible level is shown as an example. A player piano repairman has a gauge I made for him, a vacuum gauge. All kinds of stuff that were things that I used at Smith Kettlewell. And what do you know? I looked through it after I finished it, and I'm not in there. I'm not mentioned once. I didn't mention me once. Why? Because I'm all, my sister always wants to call me an inventor. I don't think I've had an original idea in my life. But I know what I observe, and I'm analytical enough, and I see this world as tinker toys to put together. But if the tinker toys become all alike, no more sticks, wheels, and no more brackets, and no more other things like Legos and Lincoln Logs and
erector sets.
Erector sets. I've got a masterful erector set. I mean, I've collected parts. And made a coil winder for a project that we're going to wind some coils. I made it out of my erector set. But, you know, what if they all look alike, what is their creativity? I don't know. I'm just hoping there are as many creative people as were before. I don't count myself among them. I was going to just mention on this electronic travel aid business. I get a lot of calls who have finally figured out how to help the blind. they're going to build this thing that'll help the blind walk. And one of them was a guy who wanted to put pager vibrators in the toes of your shoes, and then you could walk without a cane, and as you approach things, your shoes would vibrate. And I said, look, first of all, the cane gives you 5 pieces of information. You want me to go through those?
Yeah, please.
First of all, it gives you an obstacle detection system par excellence. It's there, and it's enough in front of you so that you have time to stop. It gives you ground texture information. That's how you'd know if you were going from concrete to blacktop. It gives you inclination information, so that upstairs, downstairs, you know when they stop, all of that. So it gives you terrain elevation information. It gives you obstacle identification information, because if it goes, it's a box. If it goes, it's a wall. If it goes, it's a piece of wood. If it goes tong, it's a hubcap. If it doesn't make a noise and it hits something, it's a rubber tire. You know stuff about the thing that you encounter. You don't hit things, you find them.
Mm-hmm.
That's another concept. And the last one of the things that some of us use is it makes noise in and of itself that you can use to facilitate listening for echoes, so that you can, some people count doorways, some people can tell when they go from a storefront into to a parking lot off to the side, just by the vacantness of echoes. People use them to various degrees and varying success. The sixth thing is, of course, that it lets people know, I'm somehow special and I might goof, but guess what? This is a license. In case I do goof, there better be an excuse on the part of the person who doesn't recognize that. But it also gives me a license to go anywhere subject to or involved in public trade. Anywhere. You can't say, Mr. Gary, you can't go into this bar. We don't serve liquor to, we wouldn't do it, serve a liquor to a blind person. Whatever you think about that, that white cane, I can go there. That's a fact. And I may have to call the police to do that, but I can get in there. Now, aside from that, a guy with vibrating shoes gives me, what does he give me? He gives me 2 choices. He gives me a choice to walk somewhere else I don't want to go, or he gives me the choice of doing exactly what the cane gave me, which is to walk up and find out why.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was grappling on my small way with trying to design something to facilitate, to augment the information that a person in a wheelchair, 12% of blind people are in wheelchairs, legally blind people, 12%, and it's increasing. So there will be a need for stuff, but one of the things that I recognized was that a wheelchair has a maneuverability issue that once you do find something, not hit it, but find it, turns out to be hitting it, but that's all right. Once you do find it, can you remember your exact moves to get back out of there to then try something else? And so perhaps clear path is part of the secret, to warn you, not to warn you, but to show you clear path arrangements as you go, and to present them in a way that doesn't contribute to your cognitive load, like would be vibrating shoes or things that go dee 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 dee. or whistles and wassels and so forth, or talk. You know, talk is always late. Every time a talking thing talks, it's telling you history. When you push the clock button on this on your clock, it tells you the time that it was when you pushed it. And so in any dynamic system, talk is almost always insufficient, and usually, well, it's always late, and it's very often insufficient. Can't make an electrical adjustment with a talking meter. It's very difficult. And you can burn stuff up trying, because you got the thing energized and the talking meter is talking away, and it tells you these long answers between times when you can do something about them. So anyway, all of that, what does the electronic travel aid business have to contribute? It hasn't found out yet. As Emerson Folk said, boy, there's a brilliant man too. Emerson Folk said, turns out that aiding travel beyond the use of a cane seems to be intractable.
Let me ask you a couple of questions. You were interested in the Federation hiring this New Yorker who had eight modes for but you thought that he was a guy worth getting, but you weren't excited about what he'd been doing until that time.
He had made some, he was the first to say, go ahead and waste memory. What's it cost you? You know, to package this thing is going to cost so much compared to the memory that they was wasting. We were talking about 4K bytes.
Well, sure. I had
to study to make a talking medical thermometer. So he made a talking medical thermometer for AFB.
But so this other thing, the thing that would play Mary Had a Little Lamb, that you were skeptical of.
Well, so was he.
Oh, okay. Okay.
He made it. He says, I'll make it do whatever you want. What do you want?
Okay.
Nobody could think of anything.
So what for blind people in wheelchairs, how are you going to get them the information of a clear path without cognitive load?
That's to be revealed, I think, because cognitive load is very important. Mm-hmm. We're going to get into cognitive issues more and more, too, with people who have cognitive impairments coming back from wars especially. We've got to figure out how to supplement what they would normally be able to do during the day, from anything from remembering their medications to alerting them to where they are periodically, so that they know where they are, so they're reminded of where they are. Who knows what their cognitive impairments are going to be?
But for people who are of sound mind, blind and in wheelchairs.
Well, first of all, you can't take their cane, because as you pointed out, one example of a woman with her cane in one hand and the chair in the other, there are others.
Uh-huh.
And they're doing okay. The chairs are getting more stable, so they don't tip as much as they used to. And that was a real issue. Hmm. So that's becoming less and less of a problem. And
but I thought that you'd raise the issue of people who are blind and have mobility impairment as a place where finding a clear path, electronics could do something for
you. Yes, and I think in a wheelchair there's something to that. Uh-huh. You know, the ultimate clear path detector is a dog guide. Mm-hmm. You can go to sleep at the wheel. You shan't graze your thigh on a single thing. That's the contract you make for with a dog. Turns out the price that you pay for that is that you contact many fewer things in your environment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that. Some people can argue over that price, but they can't argue over the fact that a clear path detector can at least work like that. Mm-hmm. If that's that may not be enough, but it's easy to add stuff back.
Let me tell Brian that you that at lunch today, I learned that you were unaware of the blind driver challenge, or you knew.
I only heard that there was some work going on with some.
Yeah, you were telling.
Feedback is just unbelievably complicated, and there's a cognitive load to be considered, which is quite profound. For example, I was asked to design an equivalent piano tuning aid for a blind person so that they could tune with electronic instrumentation. Now, the visual one has a spinning propeller or a circle of lights, or depending on which make and model you buy. So I thought, okay, I'll take this Velcro band and put some pager vibrators around it and wear it on my left arm, okay? That way I can tune and see what I can do. Whenever I did anything with that arm, anything with that hand, strike a piano key, anything, the stimulus was completely out of my attention. Hmm. Couldn't attend to it. It was gone. If I had to attend to anything with that hand, the stimulus disappeared in my awareness. So these are things that that have to be considered, and time delay, milliseconds may not cut the mustard when you're talking about reaction time with the system other than vision, because the visual system can address the back of the brain very quickly.
But you were saying earlier again at lunch when you were talking about the this device that transmitted from a TV camera to the surface of the skin. Weren't you saying that the visual cortex of the brain can be adapted to deal
that
with?
That was part of the theory. It turned out that's not true. But the idea was to present a camera's image to the tummy or to the, we tried all kinds of stuff, the inner thigh, the back. Turns out the opticon's not so bad. It actually worked as well as the stuff we tried. So you can make a lens adapting an opticon so that you can look at a drawing on the wall and feel it under your finger. So that works just as well. The thing is that the skin does have limitations, and they're usually fatiguing devices too. So, but the skin is very limited, because if you try and present the image pre-processed, you'll end up with masking problems. For example, this was some early Smith Kettlewell work, where we had a panel of vibrators on your, again, we tried tummy, things like that. There's a guy trying it on your tongue now. He'll have the same problem. Once you get, let's say, a square panel up there, a square of white with black all around it, and a hole in the middle so that the square is white and the background is black, let's say, so that there's stimulation as far as a square panel and a hole in the middle that's black. You can't tell the hole is there or if it's a filled in square. You simply can't do it. Hmm. And as you restrict the number of stimulators on, then you can do it. So in the opticon, a lot of people read with the threshold set that only parts of the letter showed up. And they could easily tell the difference between an S, lowercase s, and a lowercase e, and a lowercase a. So those were standard, very serious confusions. And you can find the gap if you can restrict the number of stimulators going off around the area.
You know, I was thinking a minute ago that it's a pity that you haven't stayed in closer touch with the with the at Federation's R&D committee and with the people who were doing the Blind Driver Challenge.
Hey, listen, the R&D committee, is Brian Burroughs still there?
He is.
And then they have no need for me. It's okay. It's all right. Let them go ahead.
Let me finish. I was thinking it's with your experience with what we've been talking about for the last several hours, that when the Blind Driver Challenge came up, that your experience and your thinking about it might be of value.
But no, then I'm thinking it would be negative. They won't listen to me.
Now I'm thinking probably it was better that you aren't there, because the people at Virginia Tech who are working on this come completely naive about the problems of blind mobility. It was you know, just an engineering professor who thought this would be an interesting question, and it's possible that now I told you what their device is. It's a glove with stimulators on the fingers. I don't know what maybe they could think of things that you would put aside because of experience you have. I mean, we all have that experience of not considering what other possibilities there are.
Well, let me say they might have, philosophically, they apparently did one thing right. They don't believe in the car driving itself, and no, I did not believe in a wheelchair that drove itself.
Mm-hmm.
But because, how does it know where I want to go? Well, don't you want to go somewhere? Why don't we program it to get to the supermarket? I got tired of that supermarket. I never want to go there again. I want control of it. And so when we wrote it as a proposal, which was funded, it's just I didn't get too far, from NIDRR, bless their hearts, I said unfettered access and without any restrictions. I want those guys in wheelchairs to be out there with me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be a little harder than I thought.
The preceding material is owned and distributed by the Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco, California. To obtain permission to use this content for classes or other uses, please contact us at publications@lighthouse-sf.org. Or to learn more about the Lighthouse, visit our website at www.lighthouse-sf.org.